Thank you all for coming. So my name is Claire Cole. As Jamie said, I'm a technical documentation advisor at Pathfinder International. Often I'm asked what that means. Basically, we're looking at programmatic learning. And so one of the practice actually that we're here to discuss today is something that has come out of a programmatic learning initiative we have called the Identifying and Cultivating Emerging Practices Pilot. So I'm going to take you on a little bit of a tangent for a second, but hopefully you'll enjoy it. This programmatic learning strategy, what's it about? Basically, we started in 2011 asking, we've been asking for a long time, but we started more formally asking, how can we as an organization build a structure to support across our implementing staff and our HQ staff hard questions about what's working in our implementation? At Pathfinder, we focus a lot on combined community and health system strengthening, trying to bring together these two incredibly important areas so that communities and health systems can work together to maximize desired health outcomes for the communities that we serve. So there's a lot of innovation that comes up in that. And as we all know, as implementers, often programs seem to, they'll start, we have the program design period, we set our baseline indicators, and we carry that through as part of monitoring. But as innovations occur in mid-course, how are we able to really understand those innovations, especially when they're not necessarily reflected in standard indicators that are set at the beginning of a program? So this critical thinking question is something that we wanted to look at, and we wanted to look at how we could build a structure to pursue that within the larger context of this global conversation about best practices. So we started with a desk review. We took a range of materials from WHO, USAID, UNAIDS, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, various implementing organizations, and we were really looking to first try and understand, how is everyone discussing best practices? What are the criteria being used? How are we thinking about thresholds of evidence? What are our standards for methodology? As you might imagine, we found a lot of variation across how these agencies are thinking about these issues, but we also found some commonalities. So the conversation about best practices is breaking down also into tiers. There's emerging, you might say, promising, best, and thresholds for evidence also mirror that. So emerging practices having the most sort of nascent type of evidence, and best having the highest quality. This illustrative quote from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I think, teases this out nicely. We have research-validated best practices, which is this highest level comprehensive research and evaluation. But they're also recognizing field-tested best practices that are supported by subjective and objective data sources. That was interesting to us. Again, going back to this idea of when the indicators are set, what about after, when we start to innovate? This quote from UNAIDS, this is a summary booklet of best practices, also kind of for us confirmed the space that we thought we might want to move into. We know that the summary book of best practices did prioritize inclusion of practices that were coming from grassroots implementing organizations, and they recognize a trade-off here. So they're moving more, orienting themselves towards action rather than methodological purity, and they're discussing formal evaluation of the type that's done by academic and government institutions as a very expensive process that may actually cost more than the actual program that's being implemented. Obviously, even from an ethical standpoint, that's not something that an implementing organization can do. And yet, there are key insights that come from our innovations that we do think should be contributing to this global conversation about what works. So given that this is an ill-structured sort of problem, how could we still be brave enough to move into this space as an organization? So I've given you that problem statement. How can we think more critically about what works, again, across our staff, including our implementing staff in the field? We developed a workshop, and that was really oriented towards building the capacity of our implementing staff to ask these critical questions. And just to give you a sense of how we structured the thinking, there was a lot more thought that goes into it, but loosely, we said, think about an observed desired result that you've observed in the course of implementation. Think about activities that you think may have had some relationship with that result. And then be scrappy, essentially. Think about whatever data sources you have readily available to you that you might be able to use to tease out if there is any relationship between that activity and the observed result that you've seen. So now I'm coming to the practice. You have a picture here of the Mwatwa Health Facility. It's based in Mogavola's district, Nampula Province, Mozambique. In November 2011, we conducted the first of these workshops and brought together five different programs from our Mozambique country office, one of which was the Strengthening Communities Through Integrated Programming, SCIP program, and the Mwatwa Health Facility is involved with the SCIP program. The practice itself was actually developed by the MCH nurse, who's pictured here in white. A little bit of background. We know that maternal mortality is a major issue in Mozambique. There have been improvements in the last 10 years, but it's still a priority for the Ministry of Health. And so there are these broad-reaching sort of recommendations of how we should think about work as implementers when we come into this space. They do recommend engaging traditional birth attendants. They recommend community mobilization, and they also recommend humanization of the delivery process. That being said, we know anecdotally that these recommendations are implemented to varying degrees in the country. So when the MCH nurse started working with Skip, they really wanted to think of how they could be a little more thoughtful and systematic about combining these areas. And so they have this two-part practice, community-based interactive discussions and MCH nurse TBA mentorship. So a little about those community discussions. We call them hot topics discussions. They begin with the MCH nurse participating in a training of trainers model where she learns how to use Pathfinder's Pathways to Change tool, which is a game-like tool that enables participatory identification of facilitators and barriers to a desired health behavior. So in this case, institutional deliveries. She learned how to use that tool, and then she came back to existing community leadership councils that existed in every district in SCIP. Those councils bring together basically influential decision makers, community leaders, and also traditional birth attendants to think about health issues and how they might work together to address those. So she taught the CLCs how to use this tool, and then together they went out and mobilized the community to come and really think about these issues and do this participatory identification of barriers and facilitators to institutional delivery. This was also an opportunity for the community to learn many for the first time of the importance of institutional delivery and the risks of home-based birth. The second part of the practice is a TBA training component. So with this, the MCH nurse enrolled first traditional birth attendants in the program, and then they participated in this training. The training was a 3-day training. It focused on building the TBA's understanding of some key areas, pregnancy danger signs, MCH basic information, delivery postpartum practices, breastfeeding, referral practices for ANC and HIV testing, and also how to help women navigate services once they came to the facility. This was also a time when the guidelines for TBA involvement in the delivery process in the facility were established, and many of us know TBAs may not have an incentive to participate in deliveries if they're not included, so their inclusion was a major part of the program. And they really function much as a doula might be considered domestically, so bringing the woman to the facility, giving her physical, emotional comfort during the delivery process, liaising with family as appropriate, and including also families' desires for rites and ceremonies in post-birth, however safe and appropriate. The trainings were then followed by monthly supportive supervision meetings in which all the TBAs would come together with the MCH nurse. And together, and this is important thinking about TBAs being invited to really think about evidence of their own performance, they would review clinic register data, look at trends in institutional delivery uptake, and problem solve together. What can we do better? What do we need to collaborate better on? This was also an opportunity for the MCH nurse to gauge need for any refreshers in terms of basic MNH information among the TBAs. So now we come to evidence. And here I want to take us back a moment to what I was saying earlier, that we're trying to think about how to think sort of outside of the box, step into this ill-structured problem space, and think about what kind of data sources can we use to ask hard questions of our work, and particularly among our implementing staff, many of whom have never been asked to do this kind of thinking before. So given that, a little context that the team during the training wanted to take into consideration. As I mentioned earlier, maternal mortality is a priority issue in Mozambique, 408 maternal deaths per 100,000 live births, and that is improvement over the last decade. We know from SCIP baseline data in Nampula province, 63% of deliveries are performed in a health facility, 10% with TBAs. We also think that anecdotally in Mwatua, it's probably a bit different. There's a lower institutional delivery rate and a higher involvement of TBAs. But at the facility, other things to know. It's one of six of its kind in the district. All of them are the sole point of contact for their locality. They have a maternity facility. They don't have any inpatient care. On average, the community members are traveling around 20 kilometers or about 12 miles to get to the facility. So transportation and distance is a major issue in institutional deliveries, in addition to community knowledge of the need for the service and thus demand. So during the workshop, and here I want to just paint it for you a little bit, the teams came in with whatever data they could bring with them, not knowing what they were going to find during these 5 days. But it was nice because we had M&E advisors, program managers, and implementers all together in this space to have these conversations. So they were looking at Mwatua institutional deliveries, and they did see this uptick. But because they were also all together, they could sort of piece more more parts of the puzzle together. And they found that around March 2011, when you can start to see the increase happening, that also happened to be when the MCH nurse began the TBA mentorship component. And then in July, where you see a sharp increase, that was when the hot topics began. So just based on this, the team decided they wanted to see if they could understand anything a little bit more. So they had to think of what data sources were available. The clinic register did provide data on when women came in for institutional deliveries, what community had they been coming from, were they referred by a TBA. That was good. The MCH nurse was also keeping very good records of the hot topics discussions when they were occurring, as well as the TBA enrollment and participation in the mentorship component. So given that, and also the fact that implementation has limitations, the MCH nurse had not been able to implement the practice in full across all of these communities, we realized that there was an opportunity to sort of break out intervention groups. So full intervention groups were defined as those who had both hot topics discussions and greater than 50% TBA participation in the mentorship component. Partial intervention groups had one or the other. Non-intervention groups had neither. We set up exclusion criteria, and after exclusion, we had 5 full intervention groups, 6 partial, and 7 non-intervention groups. Then we wanted to look at essentially percent increase in the institutional deliveries across these intervention groups. So what did we find? In looking at 2011 to 2012 data, for which we have full yearly data available, we see that in the full intervention groups, the percent increase is more than 100%. This was promising, obviously, to the team. And non-intervention groups had a higher rate of increase than partial intervention groups. Why might that be? Are the non-intervention groups being exposed to some other intervention within the program or potentially from another implementer? This was something that they wanted to understand. Why exactly was there almost no change in partial intervention groups? It was a question. So we were happy with that because overall it looked like, oh, the full intervention group is looking like there's a big difference. But then, of course, because we're committed to asking these hard questions, we decided to try and project out to 2013. And then the story changed a little bit. So we see a dip in full intervention groups, slightly less than before, and suddenly a sharp increase in terms of percent increase for partial intervention groups. And then non-intervention groups, interestingly, another question. Why does it keep increasing? Maybe diffusion of ideas is happening. It may be that the communities are not actually being exposed formally to the practice, but women are meeting in the marketplace, they're talking, and so it's happening that way. Maybe for the partial intervention, something that the team is now considering, who knows, maybe one component of the practice is actually the one that's making the big difference. If we could disaggregate the partial intervention data a bit more, would we find that the program could save resources by just doing one and not the other? So I guess what I'm saying is I'm leaving you still with questions, but for our perspective in terms of asking hard questions about what works, the team has basically been thinking about this since 2011, and the implementing staff, the M&E advisors, the program managers, all together trying to have this larger conversation. So from that perspective, we do deem this to be a success. So what's happening next? The SCIP program has deemed this to be something that they want to see more. Obviously, we're looking at data from just one health facility. We'd like to see what it would look like and more. So the practice has been replicated in all SCIP districts, and soon we'll have data from select facilities to be able to see, are we seeing similar trends? What can we understand once we have a larger sort of cohort of data? And in addition, SCIP in 2014 will move into its end line evaluation, so we want to have some dedicated investigation there. And in terms of this larger critical question asking across a global health organization, we do think that the space that's been created to have this conversation is valuable. Certainly, we also see it valuable in terms of this commitment to combine community and health system strengthening. There's a lot of factors there that can't be controlled for. So if we can ask important questions mid-course in implementation, it's only going to make us stronger. Given that we're looking at moving the workshop forward in Tanzania, Nigeria, Ethiopia, and eventually hopefully Haiti, where we're starting up now, So I'm just going to close with a slide of my co-authors who couldn't join me today but wanted to make sure to thank you for your time.
Thank you, Claire. That was a really great presentation and really showing how community-based interventions where you have a hybrid of the traditional birth attendants with professionals from a health facility actually can work together and actually improve outcomes for safe delivery. So that presentation was about a picture of how this model can work in a district. The next presentation will be about how do we build sustainable healthcare for a whole country. And obviously this effort is not something that will happen overnight, but our next presenter will be talking about his experience in Mongolia, And his name is Dr. Raymond Price. He is Associate Director of the Center for Global Surgery at the University of Utah. And he is a visiting professor at the Health Sciences University in Mongolia, and is co-author of the book Global Surgery and Public Health, A New Paradigm. It's actually one of the first book that's focused solely on global surgery. He has been awarded the Medal of Honor by the Mongolian Ministry of Health, the Presidential Friendship Medal, an honorary membership of the Mongolian Surgical Society, and the American College of Surgeons International Volunteerism Award. Dr. Price will be speaking about the contributions of surgery for building sustainable healthcare in rural Mongolia.